16th, 2007 session of the House Committee on Workforce and Economic Development to order. And thank everyone for coming out this morning. We're going to hear House Joint Resolution number 30, and I'm going to open a public hearing on that. And first up is Vice Chair Lim.
Thank you. Chair Witt, members of the committee, and for the record, my name is John Lin, state representative from District 50, which is a Gresham area. I just want to thank you again for hearing the HJR 30. This is a very simple resolution. When I was senator in 1993, I got a letter from the fifth grader of the public school that the asking we need to bring this meteorite to our state. That has been in my thought many, many years. Finally, I am introducing this legislation, hopefully, that we might be able to bring this meteorite back to our state. This might be the small matters, but I believe this is a good thing if we could bring it back, which is in New York at this time. The Willamette meteorite has a long history for our state. The meteorite traveled from Idaho to Oregon through rivers and floods. It rested near Willamette River. Some speculate that it rested for thousands of years in that Willamette River. The Willamette meteorite is made of nickel iron. It weighs about 16 tons. Native Americans in the region considered the Willamette meteorite as a heavenly visitor. That means that they named it Tomonowas. I'm not sure what that means, but I think that means a heavenly visitor. In 2000, Grand Ronde community recognized the Willamette meteorite as a religious, historical, and cultural symbol. I would like to bring this meteorite back to our state for several reasons. First, I believe it would be respectful to the people of Grand Ronde first. Second, I believe we could house it at the OMSI and that this could be bring a lot of tourists to our state. This could be a matter of economic development. By placing this in a museum, people could come, visit, and support the business around the meteorite, much like any cultural and art icon. Grand Ronde could display on a reservation, thereby attracting visitors and spurring their economic development. And maybe this meteorite could be one of a kind in the world. And then this rightly belong to our state since it's found in our state. So for above reasons, many other reasons, I ask for your support to pass this resolution. Hopefully, with this resolution, we might be able to see the daylight to bring this meteorite back to our state. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Lim. Questions, comments from the committee? Yes, Representative Gerard.
Thank you, Chair Witt. Representative Lim, do you have an idea if we did get it back where we would put it?
I already mentioned it. That's a wide open discussion, Mr. Chair, and then Representative Gerard. And maybe a logical place could be OMSI, or it could be that they where the Mangmin Bear, where the Spruce Goose are located. And certainly this is that could be housed any locations in our state. Possibly Grand Ronde might claim it. So let's get the meteorite first and then discuss later where it's going to be. And when this the resolution passes, Hopefully, I'd like to form the task force with the governor's approval, with the legislators, and I'd like to campaign statewide. Some kind of a fundraising event from the children, everybody donating maybe $1. I don't know how much they are going to ask for it, but in case if they, it will cost some money to bring them over here, and whatever reasons, I think this will be exciting if we have, if we could have this meteorite back to our state. This will bring millions of visitors around the country, around the nation, and that this will bring a lot of dollars to our state.
Additional questions? Comments? Representative Dahlem, I think maybe the floods that swept this meteorite into the Willamette Valley were the same floods that you talked about.
Yeah, one and the same.
Maybe that's a potential location for
that. That could be.
Bringing warming the cockles of my heart.
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Representative Lynn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Is there anyone from the public that would like to testify on House Joint Resolution 30 this morning?
I have a question of the chair.
Yes, Representative
Mr. Chair.
Barnes.
Representative, Mr. Chair, I'm wondering why General Caldwell isn't here this morning.
Go get him.
I'm missing the connection, Representative.
Well, he is the government affairs director for the Oregon Military Department.
Yes.
And perhaps what we need is some help.
Oh! I'm a little slow this morning. Thank you very much.
And I would follow that by also noting that New York is in big trouble because they have artifacts and natural occurring items from all over the world there, and we're obviously not the only ones who would have an interest in a variety of things that are held either in the planetarium or museum at the Hayden Planetarium or in other museums in New York City. So I suspect that New York needs to be cognizant of that and aware of these problems.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Please. I understand, as I read some of it, that it was bought by the lady and donated to this museum in New York. So technically, since it's donated to that museum in New York, they should give us without any charge.
The cost would be to transport the thing.
Very good
transport. We will take care of that.
we'll have our troops transported out here.
They're busy right now.
Heard anybody that this committee meets way too early.
We'll need to call a few of them back home to accomplish that task.
I would be happy, Mr. Chair.
Yes. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Joint Resolution 30 and open a work session on the same resolution. We've heard Resolution 30.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Vice Chair Lim.
I move HJ 30 to the floor with the two pass recommendations.
Vice Chair Lim moves House Joint Resolution 30 to the House floor, and Representative Barnhart, does that come with a resolution with a due pass recommendation?
To adopt.
I
we would assume that was what the motion meant.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes.
Thank you very much. With a due adopt recommendation on the motion. Any questions? Discussions? Seeing none. Are there any objections? The motion is adopted.
Thank you, sir.
And on House Joint Resolution 30, is there a motion as to a consent calendar?
I would make a motion that we
could discuss. Do you want to discuss it?
I think this calls for some discussion.
Okay. So Vice Chair Lim, would you be willing to carry House Joint Resolution?
I'm privileged to carry this resolution.
So ordered, and I am going to now close the work session on House Joint Resolution 30. Thank you very much. Next up, let's see who we have here. Okay, yeah, thank you. We're going to move our agenda slightly here. And next up, we'll have House Bill 2981. I'm going to open a public hearing on that bill. And up first, please, we'd like to invite Representative Clem. Jordan, come on up.
I got my cell phones off, so there's feedback. It's not me, I swear.
Welcome to both of you.
Thank you. For the record, Mr. Chair, I'm Brian Clem, State Representative for Central and East Salem. And you'll get to hear from Jordan in a moment, but it's kind of a good story the way we met. I was just out canvassing, going door to door, meeting voters. It was in the middle of the day, and Jordan answered, and I kind of talked to him a little bit about what he did. He was just getting ready to graduate college, and he was telling me about this nonprofit that he'd been working on and getting started. And I was really impressed. I said, boy, if there's anything I can ever do to help, let me know. And so we met a few more times over the course of the fall and talked about different people I knew that were kind of connected to his issue area. And then after the election, we decided that we needed some legislation. And so this is a classic sort of at the request of bill, and we've been working together on this now for 6 months. Jordan's done all the work. I went to LC and said, take his dream, put it into a bill, and we'll get it started in the legislative process. So one thing to keep in mind today is I asked him to kind of talk to you about his concept and his idea. The bill, as most of you know, who had bills come out the last day from legislative council, might need some adjustments. So we know that the department has some questions. We actually even have some questions. So it's not a product ready to be moved today by any means. But I wanted you to hear about the idea and the concept. And then we'll go back, and if you like it, we'll go back and work on making the bill fit that. There's a few areas that we think need to be changed, and the department, I think, has some questions. And my basic interest in this, the thing that got me so excited, is I really believe that Oregon needs to grow its own entrepreneurs. We can't wait for Bill Gates to decide he wants to move Microsoft to Oregon. It's something that we're always working on to get Google to come to the Dalles, to get companies to come here. But simultaneously, we need to be developing our own entrepreneurs as well. This is just a classic example of a great idea that would help grow young people into business leaders in Oregon. And with that, I think I'll let him sell you on it.
Well, thank you very much, Representative Clement. I understand, I think, that you may have other business here this morning.
I do, if that's all right. And he's better anyway, so I might just take off.
Well, thank you very much for coming this morning. Committee members, I had the opportunity to meet Jordan and discuss with him briefly last night his bill, and I think we're going to find an individual who is thoroughly versed on the proposed legislation that he's bringing forward. So with that, Jordan, if you would please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jordan Schweiger. I'm the president of the Young Entrepreneur Success Fund, an Oregon nonprofit corporation. For the record, I would like to submit the full business plan of the nonprofit.
Thank you very much.
The Young Entrepreneur Success Fund is created to inspire and empower young people, that is college-aged and under, young entrepreneurs to pursue their own business enterprise or social enterprise. And the proposed legislation is designed around providing, I don't want to say a safety net, but a loan loss reserve fund should there arise a need to replenish a loan in case of default. So in its broadest sense, the S Fund exists to inspire, educate, and fund the business dreams of the borrowers who seek to fund their own business with capital from this revolving loan fund. We are in the process of applying for a 501c3 designation, which is currently pending, or being applied for, rather. That is, as the president of the S Fund, I have sought the contributions of banks, and to date we have 14 member banks across the state of Oregon who have agreed to participate in the program as financial contributors, contributions ranging anywhere from $1,000 on up, so $5,000 being our largest individual contribution right now. The goal is to get another $25,000 from business and from banks, and to then apply for a matching grant to carry on to the full fundraising goal, which is $100,000. $100,000 would fund, as we estimate, 50 loans to young entrepreneurs or groups of entrepreneurs. It's my desire that this program be utilized in schools in some capacity. Mr. Chair, did you? Oh no, go ahead. Sure. My desire is that schools implement this program, and on a level such that, for example, an economics class decides that they want to promote literacy and they want to encourage another unfortunate school in another part of the world to have a greater library, for example, to provide reading materials that school in another country may lack. So what they might do is create a product, and they would take a loan from our institution, and as part of their socially entrepreneurial project, they would sell the product and donate a portion or all of their funds to that sister school in another part of the world. That's the social enterprise part. One of my bankers in northeastern Oregon suggests that if a rancher, which is a common business model where he is from, if a rancher wants the son or daughter to come into the family business, borrow $5,000 to raise and sell steer, for example, to make a $5,000 loan on such a young person's loan would be a regulatory nightmare for them to answer questions on, and it simply wouldn't be profitable as there's much larger loans to concentrate on. So the idea is to fill a funding niche for young people that currently doesn't exist or simply is difficult for existing financial institutions to service. So based on that need, I've organized the Young Entrepreneur Success Fund, and I'm seeking a loan loss reserve fund to help guarantee the repayment of the loan, not that I think I'll need it as much as 10%, but also to help shift the Young Entrepreneur Success Fund and any other organization that comes up away from a strictly donation-based model, which is much more difficult and, I don't want to say less sustainable, but it's certainly more difficult. But away from a donation model and to a more sustainable model of taking loans from institutions in the form of low-interest loans, which could then be repaid, and also with this loan loss reserve fund in place, the guarantee or the security that lending institution would feel would be much higher. So that's what I wish to present.
Thank you very much, Jordan. Questions from our committee members? Yes, Mr. Lim.
I commend this marvelous young man.
Yes.
And then with a dream to fulfill and try to help many other young people. But could you give me the definition of the young? What the young means is that under 25 or under 20, what's the definition of the young?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, that's a great question. Young, as defined by our organization, doesn't specifically preclude the quote-unquote old, which I might ironically point out that I would fall into that category, being a non-traditional student. I graduated from Willamette at the age of 25, so if we defined young to mean, say, 22 or below, I myself, the creator of the fund, would be ineligible. We seek to include language that, and as part of the work we want to do on the bill, that does does not exclude older applicants, but rather emphasizes an educational component that would, say, not exclude anyone enrolled in a full-time accredited Oregon university or possibly graduate school and 1 year graduated from. So that would include people such as myself, even to this day, since I'm less than a year graduated from Willamette University. So, does that answer your question, sir?
Jordan, could you describe for us? I think it's in your packet that you handed out to us. But could you just briefly describe for us some of the discussions that you've had with various bankers and investment interests?
Yes, I'd be happy to. I met with 14 banks over a very short period of time, something less than 6 weeks. And the initial reaction was very positive, and I must say I was much less prepared meeting with them than I am with this committee today. From the meetings of the 14 bankers, 10 said yes on the spot based on a one-page executive summary, which does in no more detail what I've discussed here. So the initial reaction from the bankers was very positive. And from that, I've only heard one firm no and three other, let's see where you go with this. Let's see some more work. Let's see you get your 501c3 designation and come back to us. So as I see it, hitting 75% or approximately there, about in the banking community is a very positive indication that the private sector support this idea can and is garnering is very strong. Is that interesting?
That's exactly what I was interested in. In Jordan, are there any other models someplace else in the United States, or is your proposal here somewhat unique?
It is somewhat unique in that I know of no effort to introduce loan loss reserve legislation anywhere else in the country for any sort of a model approaching this, much less anything that concentrates on young people per se. And I have to say that the idea of loaning money to young people who wish to start their own business is not completely unfledged. It was done a number of years ago in the 80s through Dell Smith's organization, Evergreen Aviation. It was called the Kid Bank. It was promoted by co-author for Chicken Soup for the Soul, Mark Victor Hansen. And in fact, the banker who was part of that project, his name is Bruce Bryant. He's the president and CEO of Town Center Bank. He's excited to be part of this and also to be a sponsor bank of this. He said in his experience of seeing 40 to 50 loans during his short time with that program, he saw only two or three problem loans. And that's not to say there were full defaults, maybe just late repayment. So going back to what you said, no, I don't know of any other effort or organization that is currently thinking towards this. This is completely new and, in my mind, innovative. And
I know also that based on our discussion last night that you have some ideas of some younger individuals who could use this access to capital. Could you give us some examples there?
Well, sure. There are a couple of famous stories of young people who applied to the previous fund who come to mind currently. One was Tommy Tai. He was 6 years old. He printed a bumper sticker that says, "Peace, please do it for us kids," signed Tommy Tai. I'll make a very long story short. He sold 2,500 bumper stickers, as I understand, by the time he was 8 or 9, sold including such distinguished people as former President Ronald Reagan, Mikhail Gorbachev, who sent back a bumper sticker order with $1.50 in U.S. funds and said, "Tommy, go for peace," signed Mikhail Gorbachev. And also, this young man was able to garner some notoriety, or rather, not notoriety, but national media exposure. The Orange County Register picked up his story, did a little interview, and asked the young man Tommy, do you think you can stop all the wars in the world with this little bumper sticker? And he thought about it a second. He goes, no, I think you have to be 8 or 9 to stop all the wars in the world. Joan River asked a similarly pointed question at the end of an interview in which Tommy appeared on TV and said, Tommy, what sort of a difference do you think your bumper sticker's really making out there? And this was back in, I believe, the late 80s or early 90s. And Tommy shot back quickly. He said, well, I've only had my bumper sticker out 2 years, and we already got the Berlin Wall down. true story. That's perhaps the very successful, and that's certainly the goal I'm shooting for. I would never dissuade any young person from dreaming that big. But the use of these funds can range anywhere from the $200 lawnmower request, where some young entrepreneur goes and mows acres of fields, which is how coincidentally Mr. Dell Smith of Evergreen Aviation got started, to on the high side the baby beef concept I brought up that would be applicable in Northeastern Oregon.
Okay, thank you. Jordan, thank you so very, very much for first your testimony, but most importantly, as Vice Chair Lim said, your bill. This is a very important move for a lot of young folks to be able to get them adequately capitalized and into the business world. Thank you for bringing this forward.
Thank you very much. It's been my pleasure.
Next, I'd like to call up Gene Arana and Dave Weiss from OECDD, please.
Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jean Arana, and I'm the Central Operations Manager for Oregon Economic and Development, Community Development Department. With me is my colleague, David Weiss, who is one of our business finance officers within my division. And we are very happy to appear before you today to really raise the questions that come to mind for the department when we see legislation such as 2981. And the department is neutral. We just really feel that we need to be able to ask the questions of the kinds of impacts that this particular legislation would have on our department. Mm-hmm. The bill appears to recommend a modified version of our existing capital access program to provide loan portfolio insurance for loans made by 501c3 nonprofit organizations to young entrepreneurs. And while it's patterned after our existing capital access program, the proposal does raise questions about the different key aspects that we feel would need to be addressed if this is to move forward. First, our capital access program utilizes highly experienced banks and other private lending institutions to manage the loan process from application to closing. 2981 does not appear to include standards related to lending experience for nonprofit organizations, which could result in the departments providing loan portfolio insurance for loans made by inexperienced organizations, particularly in lending, and it does increase the overall risk of loans and potential for loss. Second, by design, our capital access program removes the department from the loan underwriting process, and this service is performed by qualified financial institutions. House Bill 2981 seems to imply that the department would be involved in the loan underwriting in this alternate program due to the provision that the qualified entity would provide the borrower's financial information to the department. Thirdly, the capital access program does require borrowers and private lending institutions to make a contribution to a loan loss reserve account, and then the department matches that contribution. This requires the public and private partners to share the risk and helps build the loss reserve account. 2981 does not have that same provision, and as a result, it would appear that the department would incur all the risks associated with the loans. In addition to programmatic issues raised, there are a number of administrative questions that the department would like to raise. The startup and ongoing administration of the program would appear to impose new cost burdens on the department. And while the bill allocates $50,000 and states the department may charge administrative costs, the source of that funding isn't quite clear. And with no new funding source, the new and additional costs have the potential to further reduce the funds available to our existing capital access program. Our program has been highly successful. We have 30 banks and credit unions enrolled. However, for the reasons discussed above, 2981 would appear to open the existing program to higher risk lending practices. In addition, the bill, as it's currently drafted, states that the department will fund the loss reserve accounts of nonprofit organizations with an amount equal to 10% of the total loan corpus. However, only $50,000 is allocated to fund those contributions to loss reserve accounts, which has the potential to require the department to divert funds that go towards loss reserve accounts of private lending institutions to the new program, which dilutes the resources available for the existing program. This could potentially impact the department's other business finance programs as well. And our conclusion, again, is really to raise the questions, to provide you with information, and to really ask that more information be provided to fully articulate what we believe are currently outstanding issues and potential impacts raised by the legislation. I'm not the subject matter expert, and that is why I brought David. So if you have specific questions, I would certainly, we will be willing to respond to those.
Thank you very much. And before we continue, I'm just going to, for the record, put us into a subcommittee at this point. Yes, Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm curious as to whether some form of formal report of the CAP is regularly prepared.
I'm David Weiss, Business Finance Officer with the department. We do an annual statement, financial statement, prepared by our fiscal section. We'd be happy to provide the committee with a copy of that. We also do regular monthly updates on loans enrolled in the program, claims made, that kind of thing. So, yes.
Thank you. I think it might be useful, Mr. Chair, for us to get a copy of that, maybe the last couple of reports.
Okay.
Because it does appear to me, based on the testimony, that we may be talking about a program which essentially duplicates something we're already doing. I wasn't aware of it, but I'm not aware of a lot of things the state government does, so I would appreciate that.
We'd be happy to do that.
I'm similarly situated, Representative Barnhart. Yes, Representative Dolan.
I'd also like to know where the overlap is. It sounds like it's very similar, but I would like to know what portion of this portfolio is allocated to loans like those that were described, so that we might be able to compare apples to apples and oranges to oranges.
Yeah. That was the point of my request, essentially, yes.
Yeah, because this is really a banker-driven program, we don't have the kind of detail on the borrowers that we do on our programs where we're a direct lender. But my sense is there are not a lot of loans in the portfolio to applicants like this. I do not think there is a lot of overlap, but I think there's probably potential for there to be some overlap and for loans to be made to borrowers like this out of the program.
A follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Yes, just momentarily here. We've retained our quorum and are back in the full committee. Representative Dolan?
Would it be possible to add this service to the services that your agency provides? We would be reaching a new loan audience. Is that possible?
You mean, are you saying without modifications to the existing program?
No, I certainly adjust the program so that it fits within the parameters of your guidelines. But it seems to me that we're dropping lower so that we might reach a larger audience. And it seems like their threshold where you stop is where they start, it seems to me.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dahlem, that is an excellent question. I think, again, those are some of those questions when you're dealing with the definition of what is a qualified entity, what is the qualified lending institution, and the qualifications of the borrower. In lending, the risk is certainly an issue, and those are factors in, you know, perhaps someone coming in under this program still would have to qualify, and to reduce the qualifications for lending would certainly raise the risk factor.
Thank you.
I was wondering if you'd be willing to meet with Jordan and have a discussion about the similarities and where perhaps his bill diverges from programs that you already have. And Jordan, if you could maybe report back to me your findings after you've had that meeting, I'd be very appreciative.
Mr. Chair, Jordan has come in and met with our finance folks as well as the deputy director, and we certainly would be happy to sit down with Jordan again and talk about the differences and, again, see if we could get some of our questions answered.
Okay, great. I'd appreciate that very, very much. Any additional questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank
Chair.
You. I am not seeing anyone else signed up on this bill. Is there anyone else from the public that would like to testify on House Bill 2981 this morning? If not, then I'm going to close the public hearing on that bill. And if everyone will just bear with me momentarily here while I sort papers.
We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2903. We'll hear from Chair Witt.
We don't have a quorum.
Actually, we do.
Oh, sir.
He's present. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Brad Witt, state representative from House District 31, here to present House Bill 2903. This is a bill that applies to contractors providing services to state agencies, as well as state agencies that are awarding those contracts. The bill states that a bid or contract for services from the contractor must specify that the work associated with that contract be done domestically unless, and it lists a series of unlesses, that unless there is a unique set of services that cannot be provided domestically. The services possibly would be mandatory and central to the core agency functions of the state agency, or that a foreign firm has been hired to market Oregon goods and services to a foreign country, or that there be a 5% cost differential on the services provided, or that less than 10% of the work provided under the contract is done offshore, given that a significant domestic business presence is maintained by the contractor or subcontractor. the bill provides for or defines what is a substantial breach of contract under these specifications. And for what it lists as a substantial breach of contract, it provides damages in the form of a 100% clawback for the services contracted for. It also provides for the possibility of rescission and restitution under the contract and the possibility of civil action. There's also a separability clause that the bill provides in the event that any portion of it does not comport with the federal law or treaty, and applies to contracts either advertised or entered into on or after its effective 2007 date. Additionally, there will be at this point an unknown fiscal impact from this bill. Mr. Chairman, based on testimony from a previous and somewhat similar bill last week, I would note that this bill does provide certain weaknesses and probably merits an amendment should it move forward with regard to educational institutions and other potential contractors that would have a need simply by virtue of the kind of work or service that they are involved in to have an exclusion under this bill as well. And with that, I would be happy to try and answer any of your questions.
Mr. Chairman, are we going to hear from... I think I'll hold my questions if I know who we're going to...
Yeah, we have several more witnesses.
Okay, ma'am. I'll wait with my questions.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Representative. Continue. Okay. Let's hear from Jim Witte from the Oregon Department of Transportation.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it's good to be back again on a different bill. My name is Jim Witte with the Oregon Department of Transportation. What I want to do is take up the same examples I brought up last week on House Bill 2831 and sort of see how they might apply to this bill. I thought that might be a worthwhile activity. So you'll recall the IBM team, the international IBM team with particular expertise scattered about the world that we were looking to engage. You may also recall that transportation problems in other parts of the world are oftentimes worse than here, particularly in Oregon. And they develop these experts from that are working on these problems develop expertise that is really beyond what we're applying here in the U.S. And so the technological solutions we may employ here could be drawn from those that work. Now this may change over time. I'm hoping as that work and those solutions are applied to the U.S. and it may be we have more expertise here and more of the work being performed here. But in the meantime, a team that with world class expertise in particular areas of transportation innovations may not meet these exceptions here. The 10% work of contract work exception in particular. Say there's a solution that's developed for Stockholm and we're interested in it, and the experts that developed it are in Europe. I'm not saying they're necessarily in Stockholm, but they're in Europe. We may be end up with having to deal with people here in the U.S. that have read about it, and so they have that level of expertise. And they may have read the technical literature, but they don't have the on the ground expertise and dealing with the problems and really from the ground up that you really want if you're going to employ something here. So that 10% contract work exception may not work as well as unique services exception. in this case. And the second example was the Chilean expert that was pulled in midstream for a sensitive traffic stop survey work. We immediately look to the unique services exception there, and I think if you look at that alone, it's impractical, because in this case, we didn't know that the problem was going to be developed until midway through the traffic and revenue. And so if we were going to try to solve that with the unique services exception, we'd have to stop, do a scan in the U.S. to see if anybody else has that work, and then government procurement takes a while, I've discovered, and it's about 6 months minimum to do that kind of a thing. And so we wouldn't really want to stop the work. Now, I understand there's another exception on the back page of the bill, the second page, extraordinary circumstances exception that might apply there, although I'm not sure how a firm that's contracting will find comfort that necessarily will be applied, because it's such a in the moment kind of a application. Anyway, so that's the third one, or second one. The third one is the U.S.-based consultants with technical expertise that work across border in international markets. Now, this one might be covered by the 10% of contract work exception clause, but there may be cases when a firm would be faced with a situation of turning away significant work, say in Canada. It's a U.S.-based firm, because the consultants involved will be breaking that 10% of work exception. And they'll have to have the choice of either measuring is the Canada work better than the Oregon work or not, and making that choice. And I don't think that's what the drafters of this bill had in mind, is to put a U.S. firm in that kind of a situation. So those are the applications of the examples from last week. Really, the issue here is when you're dealing with innovation, non-standard work, where you're trying to find, and in transportation, that's where we are today, because we don't have traditional funds to really build our way out of the situation. And so we're looking for things like the reader boards and the ramp metering, and even in the future, maybe even be able to access trip check or something even better on your PDA. So when you get in the car, you say, I wonder what the route home looks like today. You pop up your PDA, well, I need to take a different route. What is the different route? And you find it. Immediate time. That's the kind of future we're looking at. But we have to go to where it is and not look at people who maybe have read about it as the experts we want to hire. We have people that have actually employed it. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Questions? Yes, sir. Representative Sherrod.
Thank you. The question I have is, compared to the bill that you testified on last week, this bill seems a little cleaner to me, and maybe one that we could get amendments to work with. Does that seem to be your opinion of that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gerard, that's true. This has there are things about it that are more workable than the last bill from last week, yeah.
Follow-up question?
Yeah, Paul.
On that regard, the 5% differential, 5% in your business can go into millions of dollars, can it not?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gerard, yes. That is true. 5% transportation is very expensive, although the consulting work probably is not that level of expense. When you're looking at hundreds of millions of dollars for a project, you're looking at design issues, and that's not what we're talking about here so much. We're talking about application of technology, which is much less expensive.
Representative Dallum.
Yes, Mr. Whitty, in your opinion, can this bill, with movement of its parameters, be moved enough to make it fit the confines of your business?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dallum, if you work at a bill long enough, you could probably do about anything with it. You can solve most problems if you have the time, yes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Let's call next Jim Craven from AEA. Welcome, Jim.
Welcome, Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair. Although Mr. Vice Chair is not here. Jim Craven, representing the American Electronics Association. Like my good friend Mr. Witte, it's great to be back. Seems like we were just here a week ago. I'm not going to repeat everything I talked about last week about the changing global economy and the unintended consequences of this bill, though I will highlight a few of them, and the fact that I guess since last Friday, I still believe that the world is still flat and nothing has changed a whole lot from last week. The gist of our position in the high-tech industry, and I do represent the American high-tech industry, though we do have certainly deployed resources around the globe, is that the U.S. does face serious challenges to its competitiveness and the need and needs to take enormous and immediate steps in the area of improving education, in funding basic research at the federal and local level, and having smart immigration policies so we can draw bright people from around the globe to work here in the United States, and to look at the cost of doing business in this country so American companies can be competitive. But we believe that the outline of House Bill 2903, well intended to combat offshoring or outsourcing, I think could lead to retaliation from other states and other companies, less competitive businesses, and ultimately higher cost to taxpayers. It's simply a fact today that Oregon is involved in a global economy, and legislation such as 2903 seeks to penalize companies that have a multinational presence. And I think it sends a negative signal to those investors who invest in this country. As I pointed out last week, there are tens of thousands of family wage jobs in Oregon who are sponsored by companies that are headquartered elsewhere on the globe. House Bill 2903 says that a contractor who wishes to bid for a service contract for the state of Oregon, unless they meet some of these exemptions, is precluded from using any employees in other parts of the globe, even their own employees who may work at physical locations outside the domestic United States. Conditions change fast in this world. Sometimes contracts are multi-year operations. And because this has sort of life of contract provisions, once you sign the contract, basically the terms of domestic content and all that live for the life of the contract, I think, you know, can run counter to the fact that the world does change quickly and companies need to deploy resources the best way they can to meet the effectiveness and save dollars for the taxpayers. Just one small example. Say the state of Oregon were to let a contract for a complex database redesign with a private sector provider. Under 2903, the successful bidder could be precluded from using their best employees, wherever they are in the world, to produce the product, could be hampered in using the increasing software development model, which says in many cases employees around the globe work 24/7. People work during the daylight hours in the United States on a contract. It shifts to, say, Bangalore, India during the night and shifts back to the United States during the day. I mean, this is increasingly an amazing but common business model, which does allow for more rapid time to market and best deployment of resources. There are concerns that under some of these conditions in the bill that business model would be precluded in order to bring the state of Oregon the best and the cheapest solution. I think it will inevitably limit bidders on Oregon contracts, companies that just say, I either can't meet these tests or don't choose to meet these tests. So when you limit potential bidders, you limit both solutions and price. I guess just thinking about this and having worked on this issue for several years, when you get into the world of public contracting and public procurement, you know, what's that line between social policy and best cost solution to save taxpayer dollars? We think also that this will could lead, and I haven't seen any kind of fiscal impact yet. I don't think you have it. But substantial new costs for DAS in terms of contract administration. They've got to ask for a whole lot more information under these provisions than they currently do in contracts. And there's also provisions that they would have to monitor contracts over the life. I'm not exactly sure how that would work, but they check back with the contractor every quarter to say, are you using anybody in Vietnam this month? If so, and you think of the really terrible possible outcome of contract rescission or stopping work in the middle of the stream or pursuing costly litigation to claw back contract price, I just think there are a whole lot of issues that this raises that we find troubling. Last session, in 2005, we participated in a work group on a very similar kind of idea. And Tom Chamberlain was part of that group when he was currently, at the time, working in the governor's office. Tim Nesbitt was part of that group. Myself, Paul Cosgrove, Dugan Petty from Department of Administrative Services. And we did wrestle through this. And we looked at different ideas and scenarios. And I can't speak for them, but from our point of view, we couldn't find an effective solution. We had, I think we had one public hearing in the Senate, and the bill didn't move past that. So that's just a little bit of history, and happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Craven. Questions? Representative Girard.
Thank you. The question I would have, I think everybody on this committee has a problem with outsourcing and that we're seem to be losing jobs overseas. If we kind of modify the bill so the phraseology would be like strongly encourage or something like that, you wouldn't have a problem with that, would you?
Mr. Chair, Representative Girard, I can't prospectively pledge not to have a problem with something.
Okay.
I do believe, and as I pointed out last week, in terms of Oregon bidders on contracts, the current Oregon public contract law does provide sort of an all things being equal test. The Oregon bidder gets preferences. I mean, that's currently in our public contracting law. When you push the envelope of preferences too hard, what happens? You know, let's put aside the offshoring issue for a minute and just think of state-to-state competition. States that provide in-state preferences to in-state bidders in Oregon, we retaliate against them by punishing them with the similar percentages is the way I understand it. So that's kind of the way it works. When one person provides a numeric preference, if they come in and try to bid on Oregon work, we deduct the numeric preference, sort of on keeping the level playing field. So I'm not sure how I would suggest improving the bill at this time.
Further questions? Thank you, Mr. Craven.
Thank you.
We appreciate it. Are there others who would like to be heard on House Bill 2903? Okay. So with that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2903, and I pass the gavel back to the chair.
Thank you, Representative Barnhart. And we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 139A. First up, let's call a panel up here. Dan Clem and Jody Brewer, please.
Good morning. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dan Clem, and I am less than a month as the interim director of the Oregon Department of Aviation. And with me today is...
Hello, Jody Brewer.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we bring... the Department of Aviation asked for this bill, not because there is a problem in Oregon, but there's a problem in countrywide. And it's the continuing closure of airports. There are many reasons for airports closing, mostly smaller general aviation airports. But when that happens, it has dramatic effect on the community and really the states or the region's ability to have multimodal transportation, which is increasingly more and more important to communities. Throughout the country last year, 280 airports closed, and again, communities were affected by that. So this bill intends to at least provide for a notification system so that the businesses, the communities, the homes, the general aviation, persons that use that airport at least have some react time to pursue alternatives, which may include purchase or alternative airports, or finding some way, as we try to in the Department of Aviation, seek grants to keep airports up and running. So this bill intends to try to protect airports. Another important point is that 57 of Oregon's 97 airports receive or are eligible for FAA grants, and when you take an FAA grant, you have to sign a grant assurance that says FAA essentially has a lien or an interest in those improvements over a 20-year period. If an airport, for whatever reasons, whether it's a public airport or a private airport, closes, there's the whole potential of not only, you know, affecting the community, but the financial issue of the FAA grant assurance, which may have to be paid back or satisfied in some way. So at least with a notification, you know, there's some preparation time to try to work through those issues. Also, the Oregon Department of Aviation assists all types of general aviation airports and other airports with financial aid to municipalities, what we call FAM grants, and pavement maintenance program grants. We are similarly looking at requirements to at least understand if an airport's going to close or change, how that affects how we made with Oregon taxpayer money investments in those airports. So there's a similarity between how we treat, you know, requirements for receiving federal money as well as Oregon state money. Chair.
Could you just a little more distance from the mic, and I think
you
can come through a little clearer.
Okay.
Super. Thank you.
Thanks. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, last session, Senate Bill 680 was put into effect. It's the Through the Fence program, which is intended to provide the use of aviation assets to promote economic development, to use the airport to allow through operators of businesses near or outside of the airport to have access through the fence of the airport to stimulate economic development. And this sort of understanding of an airport's in trouble or it's going to close would not only affect folks on the airport, immediately directed by whether or not planes can land or not, but also businesses who may not have anything to do with airplanes, but that aviation business is important to them for their own economic activity. In the Senate, this was amended, and there were two changes made. And just for your information, the word permanent was added so that you could distinguish between a temporary closure and a permanent. And this bill tends to emphasize permanent closure. And then we originally had asked for 6 months, 180 days, and felt that maybe a more reasonable period in the Senate was 120 days. And so what you have before you is that amended version. Just in closing, this bill has a support from, and I'll speak because they have previously on the Senate side, from the State Aviation Board, from the Oregon Airport Managers Association, from the Oregon Pilots Association, and from the Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association. So with that, I can, less than a month on a job, try to help answer any questions you may have.
Representative Dahlem.
Have we had an airport close that this bill would have prevented it in the last 5 years?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dahlem, when I asked the question, we've had airports closed, but we had the ability to see what was happening prior to. So we've had airports closed, but this bill would provide a formal process where we would have known about it sooner.
Representative Foley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize for being late today. I'm kind of curious, you know, if the purpose of the notice is to give the community and the businesses and the like to try to come up with an alternative or look into how they can, you know, perhaps save the airport or anything like that. I'm really kind of curious what the reasoning of reducing the time from 180 days to 120 days to try to solve a problem as complicated as the economics behind a particular airport. It seems like to me that 180 days would be, even that would be a pretty tight time frame for something so complex. And so I'm sort of curious why, what the reasoning to move to 120 days being more appropriate on the Senate. Can you answer that question for me? Is 120 days really enough time to save an airport?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holvey, I believe that 180 days would help help the department in being able to play a role in being able to notify and work with all the interests concerned. The move from 180 to 120 days may have been, as I can't speak to it directly, may have been as a result of a number of private airport owners who may want to make decisions on investments, and they wanted a little bit shorter time period simply to allow them to move out faster or to relinquish ownership of the airport faster. So the 180 days would, that's the reason we asked for it initially. We feel that we can make the 120 days work in terms of notifying and helping the community seek alternatives or take a look at the department doing what it can to operate the airport in the interim.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. This is really a follow-up, I think, of the questions that were just asked. Can airport finances really collapse fast enough that 180 days is impractical, whereas 120 days is not? And that seems very unlikely to me, that things would change that fast.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, the airport closures that have occurred for a number of reasons, not always, finances. There are private property owners or municipalities who find all of a sudden they've got financial activities, and keeping the airport open for 4 more months when you're losing money or it's proven not to be a good investment. They're wanting the shortest time frame as possible simply because they may not have the money. I haven't seen instances of that here in Oregon, but at least from my staff and advisors that I've sought guidance from. But I think that the 120 days to a municipality or a port or a private owner, to them it may seem quite a period of time. We haven't seen any immediate financial issues of late.
Just to follow up, are any of the airport closures that you know about the result of a business decision to use the land for something else that might be more lucrative?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, in Oregon, those were...
I wasn't restricting my question to Oregon.
To Oregon, sure. On a nationwide basis, there have been some immediate closures based on financial issues.
Excuse me, I'm not talking about finances of the business, but a decision to use the property for some other business.
Sure. There have been airports turned over for developments, and quite frankly, the community and the operators, jurisdictions involved were surprised about it. Predominantly in the East Coast and Central States areas.
Well, Mr. Chair, given the importance of airports to our common community, 180 days seems like a minimum amount of time you'd want to ask an entrepreneur to wait to see if you can buy him out rather than close an airport to use the property for something else.
Point well made, Representative Barnhart.
Mr. Chair, we would support that 180-day, which is what we originally asked for.
Representative Dole?
No, I think Representative Barnhart has hit the nail on the head. I'm weighing here a compelling public interest. I know the value of airports in the area that I represent, and they're not international. They do not carry a huge traffic load. But when you need something in spray or fossil and have asked for it by air, you need it. And to not have that facility, I'm weighing the public's right to have appropriate notice against the capital loss. But if you're going to open an airport, I guess you ought to, one of the business arrangements must be that if she's going in the tank, you'll have to be prepared for 180 days. Even that seems short to me.
It does to me, too.
I would much prefer the 180 days. I'm thinking of the businesses that the airport supports.
Yeah.
So I guess I'm not asking any questions. I'm not making any comment that hasn't been made, but I am perplexed why we would drop to 120 days.
Representative Holman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm glad others see that kind of popped out at me too, 180 days. And, you know, frankly, somebody that's got this kind of investment in an airport should be thinking a little bit more long term in their financial planning. And it seems like 180 days is short. I'd like to see a year, quite frankly. But notwithstanding that, in the bill itself, it mentions a public use airport. And so, you know, given that it's a public use airport, I think that, you know, that we really need to weigh that in this, in the, considering the time frame of shutting down a public use airport as opposed to a private airport that's just strictly private. And I guess maybe I'm looking for a little more clarification on the definition of a public use airport as opposed to an airport that's strictly a private use airport, because this bill doesn't apply to strictly private use airports. So can you give me a clarification on that definition?
Sure, Mr. Chair. Representative Holvey, public use airport is defined as one essentially that may be privately owned or publicly owned, but that has been cleared by the Department of Aviation or FAA for use by the public. Dirt strips can be public use airports. I think I'd like to add to the point about this public use airport. Those play also a critical role with medical operations and emergency operations, emergency response operations. So a public use airport really is one that we've mapped out with Oregon Emergency Management to also provide search and rescue and or local community emergency response too. Whereas there are a number of small private strips, some we don't even know about, that are not cleared for public use.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. Again, this is another follow-up. I was going to ask the question that Representative Holvey asked, but your answer generated another one, and it's simply because I don't understand how these public use airports work. I know there's some airstrips on farms near the Interstate 5 freeway, and I drive past them and see people in the summertime using them. At least a couple of them, I'm quite certain, are private airports, because airstrips are only used by the person who actually owns the land. Mm-hmm. And this bill would not apply to those, would it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, that is correct. This would not apply to them.
Okay, and then the follow-up, if I may. Once you've gone through the process of getting the FAA approvals and whatever the licenses are you are referring to, does that then open an airport, a public use airport, for emergency services and things of that sort, sort of as a part of the licensing agreements, or is there something else you have to do in order to open an airport for public use even after you've gotten those kinds of permits and agreements?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Barnhart, I don't know enough yet about any specific requirements for an airport, a public use airport, to be certified. I know that once it's listed as a public use airport, we use it in a planning system. We provide, FAA certifies the airport. And many of those airports are state-owned airports. We actually provide the maintenance on those airports. So of the 97 airports, a number of those, 27 of those, are owned by the state of Oregon and operated by the state of Oregon. So in terms of through the licensing and registration process, I'm not sure of all the technicalities of how it's categorized. It kind of depends on the operator of the airport. Again, public use airports are privately owned and owned by ports and municipalities in the state of Oregon. So each of them has their own features. But in any and almost every case, emergency response and medical evacuation are certainly conducted at those activities. I'm not aware that there's a large body of requirements for it to be used for emergency response.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Representative Dahl.
How long does it take to get the word out to aviation companies, private pilots? My experience with flying is we had a map that was horrendously accurate. How long does it take for the flying public to realize that a public airport is closed? and have that information generally known and accepted so that you're not counting on that landing place for safety, emergency, that sort of thing. How long does that take?
Sure, Mr. Chair, Representative Dahlem, in working some recent issues in terms of notification, it generally takes about 2 weeks for communities and for businesses to know about it, but it takes 2 months to get it out to the pilots. Simply because a number of the pilots still operate with printed, you know, IFR charts, Jefferson IFR charts, and a number of other publications. There are immediate, what we call notice to airmen, NOTAM notices that go out, but we can't say with certainty that it doesn't take at least a month, if not 2 months, for any pilot that could be landing there to get that notice. So businesses, municipalities, 2 weeks, pilots a month to 2 months, and it's the pilots that you've got to get to in terms of airport operation.
Jody, did you have anything that you wanted to add?
Well, I think I could answer one of Representative Bernhardt's questions, and I'm sorry, I can't remember. There was a couple questions that you asked. I think one of them, the prior question, I'm sorry, what was the question? It was about
emergency
responses. And yeah, there are airports that, of course, pilots, well, first of all, we have a gentleman, his name is John Wilson, and he sets up our emergency, he kind of categorizes our airports, so they are in categories, so that we do have emergency airports that, you know, are for more specific reasons, and I think that was one of your questions, if you know, some of them are dependent on that type of thing, and they are. And we have some very small airports that are dependent on emergency services. For example, we have one that has been, if there were actually a tsunami and different types of things would happen in the state of Oregon, that this small airport that is virtually, it's not used very often, I can't remember which airport it is, but it would be one of the only airports that would be operational. Because of the different faults in the earth and the different, it would want to be one of the only airports along the coast that would be operational. So those types of things are very important, even for the safety of Oregonians, you know. So.
Thank you. That, I think, emphasizes even more, if I may, Mr. Chair, the need for plenty of notice if a crucial airport like that were to consider closing.
Exactly. And another thing I think that you asked was about, I think one of the things that you guys were thinking about is the 180 days. And, like, for example, if there were someone who wanted to purchase the land, that had the money, that wanted to purchase the land, that wanted to develop the land next to the airport, and then the airport operator didn't, and the tenants weren't ready with the money to keep the airport operational. It would give them time to, you know, fight against this land developer who has a lot of money. It would give them time to, because they've already, they're tenants of this airport, they've, you know, they've purchased this home or business. And then all of a sudden, somebody with more money might come and take away what they thought was going to be there for them. So it would give them some time maybe to talk with us and figure out maybe if we have some state money to allocate to them, or how, in fact, all the tenants could get together and work something out. So
this raises another question,
yes,
if
please.
I may. And you may not. This, if you don't know the answer to this, I wouldn't be surprised. But I'm wondering if airport use is a public, if airport ownership is a public use or under the takings clause of the Oregon and federal constitution. The reason I ask the question is the example you just raised, I think, is a clear situation in which you may want to use condemnation authority in order to actually maintain the airport in public use as we're describing it today. But of course, the Constitution has specific requirements for public use in a different sense, and I'm wondering if that has been used, condemnation has been used as a way of maintaining an airport as an airport.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, I will tell you that as we are assisting some airports that actually have privately owned land within that airport, condemnation is one of the tools that we have used and But again, that's related to private land on a state airport. I can't answer your question with regard to something we don't own.
Well, I think I know the answer, but and I think it supports what I believe already. But in case you had a specific example, right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this conversation just keeps going from one question to an answer to raising another question. And so I'm sort of curious about if we could find out how long the condemnation process might take, because I think that would be also interesting to know. The more I talk about this, I'm really getting more comfortable moving this time frame out to a notification much further than is even proposed in the original bill. Because the implications of a real vital airport to our economy and to a community are really important, and I would hate to see us not have a policy that really protects the interests of a community and our policy. And if and when we move this to a work session, Mr. Chair, I would really be in favor of moving this time frame the other direction.
Thank you, Representative Holby. Yes.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, condemnation, I'm not sure whether we, again, I can't answer the question whether we have condemnation authority over airports or land that we don't have an interest in. If it's public use, I think we probably could. I think the issue is that we are, the previous condemnation work that we've done was about a four-month period, but that's once we knew, you know, that was the tool that we needed to use. So I will tell you that's our only experience with answering that question.
And if I may, on that issue, just very quickly, I wasn't necessarily thinking the state would be the agent for a condemnation, but perhaps a county or a city might be more likely to be in the case of an airport that's important commercially. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Gerard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I probably will be the voice of dissent here a little bit, and that is that I believe that we need to differentiate private land from public land. If it's public land, I can go with longer notification, but if it's private land, I have a problem even with 120 days because it puts an interference in to the ownership of that land, and I'm one of those people that believe when you own the land, you own the land. Mm-hmm. And so I probably would be looking in the bill to have something differentiated between private and public, and I fully agree with the public that if it's a public entity, a public zone, then the 120 days can go for however long you want. But if it's private land and it's interfering with the development, then I think that's wrong.
A couple of questions here. If an airport is determined to be a public use airport, then I'm presuming the owner and or operator of that airport has to request that certification?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's correct.
Okay. And then the bill presumes, I think, voluntary compliance. Is it reasonable to expect that owners and operators of public use airports would become aware of this statute?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it calls for us to make rule. And certainly throughout, as we have an interest in protecting and enhancing aviation for communities throughout Oregon, we would do it through the rulemaking process and then through our frequent and monthly interactions with all the interest groups that and communities that are affected by our rulemaking. So we did, as I understand it, we did quite a bit of work with them before we brought this forward, and we would promulgate it by rule with just as an active process if adopted.
Within the airport community, then, it could logically one could expect that the word would get out.
Well, I have a list of all the airports. So, for example, when Senate Bill 680, I'm sorry, can I?
Please.
When Senate Bill 680 needed to be written up, I sent out an application and information to all the airports. I have a list of all the airports. So I could do that. I could send it out to all the airports, letting them know that, you know, if you have a private closure, and, you know, explaining to them, maybe we could have a process of how we could help you as well with that, you know, it kind of that way that it would, they would, it would be behoove them also to notify us, because possibly we have some monies or we have some other opportunities and ideas to give to them. So we could just add that in as a notification.
Certainly. I think that would be helpful. And then, Dan, you mentioned through the fence earlier in your testimony, and can you comment on the level of success that that has met?
Chair Wett, members of the committee, we are now, we've just completed the rulemaking this last fall and winter, and State Aviation Board approved the two other applicants for a total of three airports to be approved for the through the fence. City of Baker, Scappoose, and Aurora was in the bill through the fence. Right now I'm completing the requirement in the bill to have sample agreements between whoever the airport owner operator is and who the business is that wants to come in and do business. The bill also calls for innovative financing methods, and there's another bill that, being introduced this session to help with that. In terms of success, I think the success to date is just the acknowledgement that airports are part of the great tool for economic development and jobs in and around the airport. That word's gotten out. A lot of interest, a lot of inquiries. And as we complete our requirements to get it fully implemented, I think there'll even be more. So the success is really the acknowledgement. In terms of businesses, economic development, we work with, the bill calls for Economic Development Department to help to monitor what the net plus or minus is of the program. That probably isn't going to be seen until sometime late in 2008, after it's had a chance.
The reason I asked that question, I thank Representative Holby for bringing up the issue of the 120 versus 180 and perhaps even greater notice, is based on, I think, the point that Representative Dahlem made earlier, the dependence that a lot of ancillary businesses have relative to the existence of that airport. I know you mentioned the Scappoose Airport. The operations of Through the Fence have enabled the development of a significant number of cutting-edge industries to develop around the airport. And they are very much dependent upon the existence of that airport for the success of their business. High-tech industry, products being developed, both our private industry as well as our military, and expansions that just continue at a very rapid and successful rate. So I would agree with most everyone else, I think, here on the committee that at least in some instances it would be almost essential for us to have some advance notice beyond the 120 days, because these businesses should, and there's no reason to ever think that particular airport would close, but I could imagine that there might be similarly situated airports where that airport closes down and surrounding businesses are going to have to relocate potentially. And I don't think that's a 120-day operation.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we looked at when we originally drafted 180 days, and really I appreciate hitting the two touch points of that. One, condemnation if we needed to, of about a four-month process, and 2 months in terms of notification and mobilization to respond to it. at least initially. So that was the reason we originally asked for the 180 days. And because public use affects all of the public, when both private and publicly owned airports, it made sense that we bring it forward to you in that way.
And as someone from a State Department, I don't want you to put you in the spot of interpreting the Senate's actions, but can you explain to us perhaps some of the discussions that the Senate had as to why they reduced the time from 180 to 120 days?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, a simple comment made about it affecting folks who privately own, and the exacerbation of 6 months of continuing to operate potentially at a loss or in a bad financial position was the only comment made. It was not a long discussion. The groups that endorsed the bill asked for 180 days at the onset.
I think that's the same concerns Representative Girard that you had expressed. Now, do you know, were there any discussions that you're aware of over on the Senate side to expand it, increase it beyond the 180 days?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, no discussion was had. It was the 180 to 120 was the only discussion had.
Thank you very much. Additional questions or comments? Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
And should we work this bill, I would urge you perhaps to be in discussion with both, if you will, Representative Holby and Representative Girard, so that we can perhaps resolve some competing interests and concerns here, both private right to deal as one would with their land versus public's interest in advance notice here.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Is there anyone else that wishes to testify on Senate Bill 139? With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on the bill.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I ask to suspend the rules to vote or affirm support for H.J.R. 30 for Representative Holby.
Thank you very much. Representative Girard has moved the suspension of the rules to allow Representative Holby to vote on H.J.R. 30, was it? Yes. Is there any objection? Seeing none. Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Girard, for that consideration, and I would vote in the aye form on H.J.R. 30.
And so there continues to be no objection to that. Thank you very much. And any further business to come before our committee today, the members? Ellen, could you give us a brief summary of what we're going to be hearing on Monday?
Certainly. Thank you, Chair Witt, members of the committee. On Monday, March 19th at 8 a.m. in Hearing Room C, you all will be hearing House Bill 2809, which requires the Economic and Community Development Department to require certain recipients of economic development assistance from state funds to consider and plan for access to child care. All of the bills that you're hearing that day relate to child care. Your second one is 2810. It removes the sunset date on income tax credits for contributions to child care. And then finally, 2811 removes the annual limit on tax credit certificates issued for contributions to the child care division.
And with that, we stand adjourned until Monday. Everyone have a good weekend.
Thank you.